9. Robert Urich says no. We were so close. It would have been so perfect. His publicist seemed to like the idea. She was going along with us and it, laughed a little at the idea. At the very least, she found it diverting. Urich was just the kind of person we needed, a star, or at the time, near former star, a household name who, for whatever reason, had fallen off the national radar, someone whom everyone knew and maybe even cared about at one time or another, but who hadn't been seen for some time. We needed a celebrity who the public, the press, not to mention the hard-to-fool internet community, would believe had indeed died, but whose passing did not make national news. The celebrity, therefore, couldn't be so big that it would be implausible that his death was first reported by a small, mediocre San Francisco bi-monthly. But who? Urich was our first choice because, A, we, like everyone, had been huge fans of Vegas. B, we knew he had some sort of sense of humor, at least as evidenced by a few self-deprecating comments made on this or that talk show with regard to his role in the seminal Turk 182, also starring Timothy Hutton, and C, he was slated to star in an upcoming series called Lazarus Man. Lazarus Man. Too perfect. It's just not right for us, his agent said. Then Belinda Carlisle. We decided that Belinda Carlisle, too, would be perfect. She lives in France, says her publicist. We run through other possibilities. Judge Reinhold, Juliana Hatfield, Bob Geldof, Laura Branigan, Laurie Singer, C. Thomas Howell, Ed Begley Jr. We consider Franklin Cover, the actor who played Tom Willis in The Jeffersons, but then don't bother calling him, remembering that we cast him in what could have been considered a negative, or at least kind of pathetic, light, in an interview a year earlier. In exchange, is there anything else you'd like to say to our readers? Well, no, I have nothing to say except help me get a job teaching somewhere. If anybody knows of any position at a college that needs an acting teacher, let me know. Then genius strikes. There is one man from the world of entertainment who might have thought of this himself. One man with a brand new middle name, Hellion. One man who tours with a multimedia show featuring slides of dwarfs and retarded people. Crispin Glover. He's perfect. So perfect. Marty McFly. We call the agent. The agent has no idea what we're talking about. We fax the letter, altered to include flattering comments about all of Glover's work, including his invented nickname. Then we wait. A day later, the phone rings. I pick up the receiver and put it to my ear in the way customary to those answering phones. Hello? I say. This is Crispin Glover. He is calling from Tennessee, where he's filming a movie with Milos Forman. Crispin Glover's on the phone. He has read the proposal, and he loves the idea. He has, as a matter of fact, been wanting to do something like this. He wants to do it, and he wants to do it whole hog, wants to really fake it, wants pictures, proof, and wants then to go underground, to set up a system where no one close to him will give it away, wants to leave it be for months, have the funeral, the eulogies, the comments from other actors, all that, the whole 9 yards, and to then come back alive, triumphant. It'll be great. This will be the thing that'll put us over the top. I am on the phone looking over the center of San Francisco, the park and the giant SF MoMA humidifier, and a sliver of the bridge and hills, and I am weak from the excitement. This'll be great, I say. Yeah, yeah, he agrees. So what kind of timeline are you on? He can't do it. He can't see why we can't just push the thing back a little bit or do it next issue. But he doesn't see that all 6 of our advertisers cannot be kept waiting, and our hundreds of subscribers cannot be kept waiting. We'll call back if either of our schedules changes. You know who? I say. No, says Moody. He's our only hope. No way. We have no choice. Oh, man. He'll be fine. Fuck, okay. Adam Rich. Nicholas from 8 is Enough. We already sort of know him. One of our contributors, Tanya Pampalone, had gone to grade school with him, and they had kept in touch. With her entree, we had worked with him twice previously. First, we had run a short interview with him in which he talked to Tanya about his shoes and an umbrella he planned on buying. An excerpt. Tanya, how many pairs of shoes do you have? Adam Rich. 10. I'd say 10. I have one umbrella. I just bought this umbrella. When I bought this umbrella, it had stopped raining, and I thought that I'd better buy an umbrella, and it won't rain anymore, and I'll have it for the next time. But it has continued to rain, and it has rained continuously since I bought this umbrella. Tanya, do Do you think it's because you can predict the future?
Adam Rich. No, it's probably because I bought the umbrella.
We call Adam in his L.A. condo and explain the concept to him. He listens. We explain that it'll be this elaborate hoax, that it'll be serving a higher purpose, that of satirizing the media's interest in celebrity death, parodying their eulogies, that this will make national news, and that outside of the feeling good he'll be able to do as a result of his role in providing this educational service to a needy America, everyone will think he's bleeding edge for even associating with us. You'll be in on every step, we say. You'll have full approval on everything. It'll be great, I say, believing it will be great. I have in my heart the firm belief that if he plays this right, it will mean not only the final breakthrough for us, but, perhaps more important, the certain revival of the career of Adam Rich. I picture him sitting in a small and dingy Hollywood condominium, surrounded by Junior Emmys or whatever, his hands on a Nintendo, a fridge full of yogurt and ice cream sandwiches, his days spent gardening, watching satellite TV. He agrees. This is going to be great, I tell Toph. We're in the bathroom. He's sitting on the toilet. I'm cutting his hair. He agreed to this?
Yeah, totally. Put your chin up.
And what's the point of this again?
You have to get your chin up.
Okay, so the point is, we're making fun of these celebrity eulogies you see in magazines where, what's a eulogy?
Like a tribute. These eulogies where, when celebrities die, suddenly everyone cares. They're given these massive funerals. People cry, people weep, even though they've only known the guy on TV, some character he's played, lines he's read.
Huh. And people will believe this?
Yeah. People are dumb.
I turn his head toward the mirror, comb his hair straight down, comparing the left side and right. I have again done a masterful job. He still looks like a prepubescent heartthrob. The nose upturned, the hair long in the front, even though it's starting to thicken, darken, curl and kink, like mine. I do not like seeing myself next to him. Next to him, I am a monster. The facial hair I am cultivating is ridiculous, grotesque. My sideburns do not meet my hair and are so sparse that they look less like facial hair and more like leg hair. Worst of all, the goatee I'm working on is failing miserably because I can't even grow hair on the sides of my mouth, giving me a perpetually in-progress 14-year-old's look. I am wrinkled, bloated, with deeply carved laugh lines, and my eyes are too close together and too small, squinty, mean. And my nose is shapeless, too big. Next to his face, his 12-year-old face, smooth, proportionate, soft, harmonious. I look distorted. As if digitally manipulated, my skin pulled the wrong ways, everything stretched or compressed, grotesque.
People are going to be pissed when they find out, he says.
Well, we hope so. These are the people we want to upset. Anyone who cares about him in the first place, who would at all be moved by the death of someone they saw on TV, deserves to be duped. I mean, why should anyone pay attention? Why should some dramedy star moron loser be mourned by millions when other people are not? When the average person who lives a happy and maybe even in some ways heroic life can only attract 20 or 30 people to a funeral. When, I mean, it's unfair. It's abominable, right?
Huh. Well, to tell you the truth, I think it's kind of sick.
That's what we think.
No, I mean, I think what you guys are doing is sick. You're using Adam Rich to make a point.
Of course.
That point being that you people are just as good as celebrities like him. You think he's vapid, dim-witted, with his stupidity arising, first and foremost, from the fact that he is famous and you guys are not. The fact that at 9 he was hanging with Brooke Shields, that 100 million people know his name, 100 million more his face, and no one knows yours.
You're breaking out a character again.
I mean, you people cannot stand the fact that this silly person, this Adam Rich person, who you feel is nowhere near as smart as you people, who did not go to college and did not write captions in the yearbook or run the school's art gallery or whatever, who has not read the books you have, has the gall to be a household name, or was it one time around the world, for something like acting in a dramedy that you find unimpressive. So you make fun of him, first with the umbrella interview, and now with this so-called well-meaning hoax. I mean, can it be any more gruesome and transparently symbolic? You people killing this contemporary of yours, a kid on TV when you were kids watching TV, this victim of your predatory mentality, who you claim is in on it all, but who really has no idea of the scale of the potential consequences of this thing, and certainly not your motivations, the bitterness simmering just below the surface, the desire to dirty him, humiliate him, reduce him to you, to below you. I mean, does he have any idea about the jokes made at his expense at the office? Could he ever imagine the malice involved? It's disgusting. I mean, what is this? What does this mean? Where does anger like that come from? It's not anger. Of course it is. These people have already attained, at whatever age, a degree of celebrity that you assholes will never reach, and you feel deep down that because there is no life before or after this, that fame is, essentially, God. All you people know that, believe it, even if you don't admit it. As children, you watched him in the basement, cross-legged in front of the TV, and you thought you should be him, that his lines were yours, that his spot on Battle of the Network Stars was yours, that you'd be so good on that obstacle course, you'd win for sure. So doing all this, when he's no longer such the world-conquering celebrity, gives you power over him, the ability to embarrass him, to equalize the terrible imbalance you feel about your relationship to those who project their charisma directly, not sublimated through snarky little magazines. You and everyone like you, with your Q&As or columns or websites, you all want to be famous, you want to be rock stars, but you're stuck in this terrible bind where you also want to be thought of as smart, legitimate, permanent. So you do your little thing, or read by your little coterie, while secretly seething about the Winona Ryders and Ethan Hawkes, or even the Sari Lockers. Remember the sellout issue? When everyone went to L.A. and New York to interview all these budding celebrities so you could make fun of them? There was that girl from Father of the Bride and the guy from Baywatch, the Australian guy, and of course the Doublemint twins. You had to make them all look like imbeciles. Even while in person you were smiling with them, joking, being kind, accepting theirs. Same with Elle Macpherson and Natalie from Facts of Life. And then poor Sari Locker, the sexologist. That was different. Right. You get a call from her publicist, a cold call because you people are on some general Gen X magazine list, and even though you would never have any real interest in the 24-year-old author of Mind-Blowing Sex in the 90s, Mind-Blowing Sex in the Real World, fine, so you say, sure, sure, let's do an interview, chuckling to yourself. You can't wait to hang up the phone and tell everyone, wanting only to tear her apart. Then while you're in New York, you have dinner with her. Dinner goes well, and you have drinks. During dinner and drinks, like 3 or 4 hours of talking, she's a little pushy and self-promoting, but also extremely generous. You had not bargained for that, and wants to hear all about me. That part shocked you. And about our parents, and says so many nice things, and during all this, while she's being kind and listening and everything, all the while you're balancing your two prevailing interests, recording her words to later use against her, because she too had the temerity to be relatively famous and attractive with the masters from Penn, while also, more pressingly, trying to get invited back to her apartment. I almost did. Yeah, you took a cab with her, watched her get out, didn't know if you should make a move or whatever, and let her go, thinking, there goes my big chance to score with a sexologist. I almost did. And then you still went back and wrote a bitchy little thing about her. She wasn't offended. Maybe she's got thick skin. Maybe she didn't read it. But don't you see this is a kind of cannibalism? That you're just grabbing at people, toys from a box, dressing them up, taking them apart, ripping their heads off, discarding them when, weird that you mentioned Sari, she's actually coming to town. Oh, Jesus, you're not going to see her. Yes, I am, young Toph. Yes, I am. I don't get it. Nor should you. Much too complex for your tender mind. Put your head down. I have to wipe off your neck. I brushed the hair from his neck with a towel. Toph, there are so many things you have yet to learn. Right, right. Just stay close to me and you will glean. Right. Fear not. I fear. He looks perfect. You look perfect. He's grimacing. It's too short. It's brutal. No, no, it's perfect. When Toph is gone, surfacing his new, to be truthful, kind of annoying social life, things are sort of weird at home. At the moment, he's at Gabe's house and there's nothing to do. It's not that I'm bored. Am I bored? I go into the hallway and lean my back against the wall. I look at my shoes. I should not wear white socks with these shoes because the hole at the left pinky toe becomes so much more pronounced with this bright white fuzz protruding.
When was he supposed to get home again? He hadn't said. I should call Gabe's house, but would that look anxious? I don't want to look anxious. Do not want to be a parent who is jealous of his child's time with friends, much like Mrs. H., whose son we liked, but who only let him out occasionally because we all felt, even at 12, we felt that she was afraid that he would come to like us, his peers, more than her, his mother. I straighten the rug in the hall. I find the broom and sweep. I open the refrigerator and throw away a heavy bag of blue oranges and baby carrots, now brown and soft. I go to my room, open the blinds. Across the street at the retirement home, an elderly woman is out on the porch, moving slowly, watering her plants. I go back to the kitchen and pick up the phone. Who to call? I put it down. I turn on the computer, get up, turn on the oven. What to cook? We have no food. I sit down, look at the computer, and turn it off and stand up, staring toward the door. I lean my head against the molding near the window. What if my head became attached to the wall? I could be half of a pair of Siamese twins, attached at the head. The other half was actually this wall. I could be half man, half wall. Would I die if not separated? No, I could survive. I would stay attached to the wall. Toph would feed me, and I would have a specially prepared chair, tall enough, so I could sit. But how would I change my shirt with my head attached to the wall? I think about this for a few minutes. Then it comes to me, button-down shirts. Oh, but the bathroom problem. I'll need a bedpan or a catheter. I could do this. I could. But my head is not, in fact, attached to the wall. I remove my head from the wall. If he got home by 4, there'd still be time to play. Is it too windy? Will he be too tired? The bell rings. I look out the window and down. It's him. A surge runs through me. Where's your key? I forgot it. I make the obligatory scoff. You flake, haha. I throw in my keys. They clink on the sidewalk. I watch him put the key in, turn, push, disappear into the wall. Should I scare him when he walks in? No, he knows I'm here. Punch him? Pour something on him? Shit, no time.
Hey. So, was it fun?
Yeah.
What'd you do?
Nothing. We got pictures today.
What pictures?
School pictures.
You got them when?
Today.
No, I mean, when did you take them?
I don't know. A month ago, I guess.
You didn't tell me. What did you wear?
A yellow shirt.
Which one?
The dark yellow one.
Was it clean?
Yeah.
Let me see the picture.
You're not gonna like it.
Why?
You'll see.
Are your eyes closed?
No.
Are you giving the finger?
No.
Then why?
You'll see.
He digs the pictures, letter-sized, cardboard backing in a plastic sleeve, from his backpack, and hands them to me and...
Good fucking God, no. This is bad. This is so bad. This is unbelievably bad. This is so unbelievably bad. They'll take him away now. They'll take him away for sure. If ever they needed a reason, now they have one. Good God, it's proof of everything. The proof they want.
Toph, this is bad.
It's not that bad.
It's so bad.
It's not. It's horrible.
Whatever.
No, you whatever yourself, whatever. God damn, you look like you're about to cry. Jesus, you're pleading for help.
And he does. Yes, he is tan and blonde and cute. He does look very cute, his eyes exceptionally blue here. But he's looking out so forlornly, so helpless, soft, neck extended, eyes almost watery. Fuck! This is so bad. This is worse than the phone voice problem. The phone voice problem we have addressed over and over, and it's improved, but still hasn't been resolved, fixed. For years, he's been answering the phone like this.
Hello?
And of course, people wonder, what's wrong with Toph? They ask me when he hands me the phone. And always, I have to be cavalier. That's just Toph, ha ha. But he does sound like he's been bawling, like he's locked himself in the bathroom and I'm banging on it, yelling over his sniffling. And he's just starting to control his breathing when someone calls, and that's when he says, hello. And worse, he achieves this same tone every time, day or night. Always this crinkly, slow, hello, at the edge of 12-year-old sanity and suffering. So I've been imploring him to sound normal. Please sound normal, Toph. You are normal. We are normal. So just sound normal, please, can't you? Don't sound like I've been beating you, like you're in the bathroom hiding from me, because I have been there, have hidden from parents before, have been on the other side of a door being struck with all conceivable parental force, have searched the bathroom for places to hide, have found a place in the closet where the bath toys are kept, under the lowest shelf, and I have hidden there, and have seen, darkening the white slit of light under the door to this closet, his shoes, and then the white light everywhere as the door is opened, and have had my shoulder grabbed, and he's been working on it. Especially when I make him do it in front of me, my arms crossed in front of me, watching, coaching, making a chipper smiley face for him, eyebrows shooting skyward, happy. And now, here we are again. This picture thing, goddamn! I should start packing his stuff up. Will the foster family be nice? Will he take good pictures for them? Foster families, foster families. Toph, this is so bad. You know what people will think. You just know. I won't be able to go to the school now. He's making a milkshake. Can you turn that thing off? It's almost done. Jesus, Toph! I can't do the next open house. I can't see them now because now they've got the proof they want. Your teachers. They must think I'm beating you. Do they talk to you like I'm beating you? What are you talking about? This is so bad. Why? You're not unhappy. Yeah, so? So you're not allowed to look or sound unhappy. Fine. Because that's what people expect. Sorry. And you didn't tell me the pictures were even happening. They sent a notice. They did not. Fine. This could be the time to escape. We should pack and go. They might be on their way already, the child welfare people. What kind of car would they drive? A big truck or something? Or undercover? We're surrounded already. We could go out the other door by the laundry room. We go out the door wearing disguises. What disguises? Capes! We do have capes. We go out and get to the car and then get provisions, some fruit, salted meats, yes, then we head for where? Mexico? Central America? No, Canada! Then we do homeschooling. We farm and do homeschooling. Oh, but Canada. Will he start saying a boot? We both will. And sorry, like sorry? Can't have that. We'll have to be vigilant. I just don't get why you didn't smile. I thought I did. I did for some of them. And they picked this one? I guess. Maybe this was part of their plan. They picked the sad picture so they can take him away, or else the photographer is some kind of child slave trader. He's hooked in with the child welfare agency, and he gets them to give him the kids and then sells them to white slavery operations in... Where are the white slavery operations anyway, and what kind of cars do they drive? I just wish you'd help me out here, Toph. I said sorry. I mean, you know how bad this makes me look? Makes us look? They're going to be bringing over more fruit baskets now. They're going to be baking us bundt cakes. What's a bundt cake? It's like a big donut. Huh. He's halfway through his milkshake, trying to put on some weight. I look at the picture again. So pretty, in a way. The yellow shirt matches his hair, so blonde after that sunny September and all the time at the beach. And the background, light blue, just right, matches his eyes. The eyes that say, "Help me." And there's not one, but six of these pictures. A grid of them, then four bigger ones below, and then this huge one. Jesus Christ. All these pleading Toves, 11 Toves saying, "Look at my sad life, you people. You viewers of junior high pictures. Class teachers, see my eyes, which have seen too much. Erase my past. Start me over. Let me be like you and everyone, normal and happy, happy. Watch me smile for my school picture. Save me from him, because every night before dinner he's asleep on the couch and so dead to the world, and when he can't get up, he tugs on my shirt and begs. He makes me cook for us, and then later, once awake, he's so tense, staring at the screen, writing something he won't let me see, and he falls asleep in my bed, and I have to push him out, and then he's up half the night, and..." "So what do you want for dinner?" "Taco. We had taco Sunday." "So? If you cook it, you can have taco. Do we have meat?" "No, you have to get it." "Can I get something else?" "Like what?" "Root beer?" "Fine. Wake me up when it's ready." Will I ever get this picture out of my head? Will we ever live it down? Is it as sad as it looks? I know it means nothing, but how can it look so transparent? Do any of the other kids look so sad? The girl whose mom and dad are getting divorced, is she crying? God, no. These kids, they know the score. They know to protect their parents, but not Toph. All I do, I changed his sheets last week. All that, and he gives me this.
My mom used to kill us when we took school pictures without her knowledge, before she would approve of our outfits. Of course, there's a reason we didn't tell her about picture day, and that reason is spelled P-L-A-I-D. Did everyone wear that much plaid in the early 70s? It's uncanny, but it seems like every picture we took before fifth grade featured plaid in some way, mostly in the pants category. And we matched, all three of us. You know, we can't send this out to anyone. I can't even show it to Bill or Beth. Then don't. I won't. Then don't. It might be right then that Marnie calls. It might be the day before, or the day after, or the next week. I'm at home, and Toph is on the couch, sighing through his math homework. The stereo's on, and I have one speaker against the wall, fighting the neighbor's must-see Thursday night lineup. The phone rings. Shalini's been in an accident. What? A car? No, no. You know that deck that collapsed in Pacific Heights? Oh, no. She's in a coma. She fell four stories and landed on her head. They don't know if she's going to make it. We go. I think we go right then. Maybe we wait until the morning. No, it must have been then. It must have been right then that we go. Maybe it is not night that Marnie calls. Maybe it is day and I leave Toph alone. Or maybe I lock... This is it. It is midnight. Toph is in bed. Carla calls me from L.A. She and Mark have moved to L.A. Shalini's mother has called her, and Carla has called me. I leave. Shalini could be gone. As I walk down the stairs, I know that someone will take this opportunity to do something to Toph. I know it every time I leave Toph home alone, which I do often now. No more babysitters because he is 13 and can be left, as long as the door to the apartment is locked, and the door to the building is locked, and the back door, that which leads down to the laundry room, is locked, then he's fine. Although that lock is weak and worthless, and so of course that's the way through which the bad man will come. He will come through the back because he has been watching, has been waiting for me to leave, knows I will be gone for a while because he has been listening to my phone conversation and watching me through binoculars or a telescope. And when I leave, he will come in with his rope and wax. He is friends with Stephen, the Scott, of course, and will take Toph and do things to him because he knows I am out to look at Shalini, who is in a coma, who fell from a building. I pick up Marnie. Moody meets us at the hospital. Shalini's family is there. The parents, her sister, a dozen cousins, uncles, aunts, some in saris, some not, other friends. The halls, shabbily shiny, are filled with people in small clumps, sitting on the floor, walking in and out of the waiting room, which has been entirely commandeered. One of the girls there had been at the party. We learn more details. It had been in Pacific Heights. Shalini had gone with a friend. They had walked around, ended up on the back deck, outside. There were maybe 20 people on it when it went, the supports giving way and all the young people floating down. The friend Shalini had come with was dead. A dozen others were hospitalized, or had been, and were released, Shal the worst among them. By all accounts, she was lucky to be alive. Her head had broken her fall. We wait in the hall, sitting on the floor, and standing, walking, whispering. They are operating. Or maybe they have already operated. They have done many operations, maybe 20, 30, 100. At some point, maybe it is the next day, we are told we can go inside the closed ward where Shalini is being kept. At the entrance to the ward, we pick up a receiver, and a nurse answers, and another comes to open the door. We walk past other rooms, and then there she is. Her face is broken. Her eyes closed, inflamed, huge. Red and purple, blue and red and purple and yellow and green and brown, her eye sockets black. She's on a ventilator. They had told us about the knit cap, and there it is, covering her head because they shaved her head and removed part of her skull to alleviate the brain's swelling. Her legs stick straight out as if in splints and are wrapped in fluid-filled leggings, blue and soft, like the masks worn during sleep. Christ, they haven't even cleaned the blood off her, at least not all that shit over her eye. I mean, that's... But her arms are perfect. Her arms are smooth and brown, without a mark or bruise or blemish. There is no one else in the room. Marnie and Moody and I don't know what to do. If we are allowed to touch her, whether to touch her or whether to talk or just stand nearby or just say hello or pray or walk by and leave. Don't you talk to the comatose? They hear, correct? Like an unborn child, they hear. We stand on the other side of the room with our hands over our mouths, whispering sideways, unblinking, until an Indian woman, a cousin or friend, comes in and, without acknowledging us, walks straight to the sink, washes her hands, dries them, walks straight to Shalini, and picks up her hand, holds it in both of hers, and talks to her.
Hello, Shalini. Hello, darling.
There are already flowers. Shal's mother comes in. She tells us that we have to wash our hands. We do, and then walk to the bed and touch Shalini's perfect arms. They are warm. After a few minutes, we are ushered out. Zev is in the hallway. We tell him what we know. He's bouncing from one foot to the other, bug-eyed, nodding a lot. We wait. Days pass. Her chances are bad. Then good, then iffy, then better. And soon the doctors become confident that she will at least be stable, though still comatose. No one is sure if she will pull out. The fall was so bad. She was standing on the platform and she... We did not know the girl who died, but we all seem to have a feeling that we've been at that house, have been on that deck. More people fly in. Carla and Mark come up from L.A. Shalini's relatives, dozens of them appear. The waiting room overflows at all hours. We meet Shalini's friends, her aunts, uncles, men in suits, and gray-haired women in saris. We eat the food in the cafeteria. We leave the hospital, and it is bright outside. It's always sea blue and sunny. And we go back to work, and then come back, and then eat and sleep, and Shalini sleeps. We bring bagels sometimes, and sometimes we feel welcome among the relatives, and other times we do not feel as welcome. Usually Shalini's mother's eyes are watery. Other times she is pacing, arms crossed, stiff-backed, demanding things of the doctors. She is a doctor herself and has assembled an elite team to care for Shalini. We meet Shalini's college friends, high school friends, cousins.
We're going to the store. Do you want anything?
You can't go in today. The doctors are in there. Come back tomorrow.
No, we'll stay.
Why will you stay? We must stay. I have done the waiting and the vigils and have negotiated with doctors and have held hands and known visiting hours. I know the rules. We are to stay. And we are not to ask questions of the parents. If we want to know something, we are to ask a cousin or a friend. We are not to smile, not to laugh at anything, unless the family smiles or laughs first. We are to dress neatly. We are to be punctual if we are expected. We are not to miss visiting hours and not take up too much time once inside, keeping waiting the college roommate or uncle from India. Most important, we too must suffer. Everyone around the ill must do what they can in terms of sacrifice and struggle, or malnourishment or sleep deprivation, to suffer too and to stay close while suffering. To leave the bedside, to leave the hospital, is to weaken the curing forces, to enfeeble the efforts toward recovery. While the ill are ill, if you can be there, you should be there. I know these things. Bizarre, self-sacrificing gestures are important. On days that you cannot possibly come visit, you must visit. When you get home one night and Toh says, "So, are you going to pretend to be a parent tonight, or what?" Which he means is a kind of joke, because you two have been eating fast food for weeks, and you've been napping on the couch every night after dinner. You should take a breath and know that this is okay, that this sort of thing, this struggle and sacrifice, is essential, that he does not understand, but someday will. And even after you have gone in to see Shalini and have seen her cuts healing and have held her perfect small hot hand, you must stay in the hallway talking to anyone who might want to talk. It is unclear whether Shalini's mother wants to talk to us or feels obligated to talk to us, but we assume that it's the former, and so we stay for hours. One day I bring a teddy bear for Shalini. I bring the tiny mohair bear that I have kept in the door compartment of my car for years, since my mother passed, because I think that there is something of her in this bear. I look into the two black pinhead eyes of this tiny, ancient orange bear with tiny jointed legs and arms, his fur worn and scratchy, and there is something of my mother there, it being the only object that evokes her so, in an inexplicably strong way that makes me unable to look into the tiny black pinhead eyes of this bear, because when I do, I think of that funny little voice my mother used when she would make this little bear talk, when I was 4, 5, 6, when we would be playing with the bears in the little house she had built and decorated with tiny furniture for them, when she would get one of these little bears out, put him in front of her mouth, and, in a high, gravelly voice, say,
"Hello."
And then,
"Let me tell you a secret,"
she would say, bringing the bear close to my ear, allowing me to imagine what secrets he was uttering. I would feel the tickle of the coarse fur on my ear and would giggle crazily. It would drive me mad with astonishment, rapture. I would absolutely lose my mind. And so one day I take this bear from the car, move him for the first time in maybe 3 years, and I bring him into the hospital, his prickly fur like a burr in my hand, and I will go in to see Shalini, who is sleeping with the wool cap on,
On the walls, pictures of her standing and happy with her mother, her sister, her eyes now less swollen, bandages off, skin collapsing around the wounds, regenerating, and I will be in there alone, and I will nestle the bear in between her arm and torso, and I will back up and see the bear sitting there, no more than 4 inches tall, its tiny black pinhead eyes staring back at me, and will feel pious and proud, and will let myself believe that it means something that I have done that, that the bear will be magic, and I will save the day and bring Shalini back.
Another day, John, who does not know Shalini, calls to offer his condolences.
I read about it in the paper, he says.
Yeah. They're gonna nail that landlord. He's got about 100 other violations on his record.
Yeah.
Is there anything I can do?
He asks.
No, I don't think so.
Pause.
So I was spitting up blood again today.
Adam Rich doesn't want his death to be a suicide. Doesn't jive with his persona. He wants to be murdered. We settle on his being killed by an unemployed dinner theater stagehand in the parking lot of the Asp Club, a fabulous Los Angeles night spot. He likes that. A violent death, and better yet, at a location that makes clear that even hours before a sudden and bloody death, the guy knew how to party. We will, in recounting his life, get around his long-ago substance abuse problems while nodding vaguely to them. Instead of drugs, we'll decide he'll be addicted to vitamin C because, while starring on Code Red with Lorne Greene, he became hyper-aware of the importance of fire safety and believed the supplements would make his skin flame-retardant. We will talk about his interest in motocross and painting and reveal to the world that Nicholas from Eight is Enough was more than an actor, that he was indeed one of the burgeoning auteurs of Hollywood, that at the time of his death, he was working on a genre-bending blockbuster incorporating multimedia and interactive elements, a mysterious, much-anticipated project known around Hollywood as the Squatter Project. He is liking all of this, this idea of the untimely death of a genius. The story begins. It is said that to fly too close to the sun will cause you to fall. Adam Rich, actor, idol, iconoclast, flew too fast and flew far. But on March 22nd, he flew too close to the sun. His peers, his loved ones, and a nation mourn.
Toph is on the couch, hunched over his history book. I am walking up and down the hall, snapping my fingers.
Please stop, he says.
No.
I am wired. Big night.
Sari in town. Toph going to bar mitzvah thing, then Sari. Okay, 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 okay.
We cook dinner quickly, and then he has to change.
Why do I have to change? Because it is a religious event, right? Where is it again?
I don't know.
Well, did you get an invitation or anything?
Yeah, but, well, where is it?
Don't you have it?
Me? Why would I have the thing?
I never saw it.
Come on, Jesus Christ.
He calls a classmate and gets the details, and of course, we are late, and he comes out of his room wearing the pants I was afraid he was going to be wearing, the ones with the ink stains on the pocket.
Don't you have clean pants?
I would if someone did laundry every once in a while.
What? What? These were never in the wash, smartass. You have to put the clothes in the wash first, you little...
Why would I put them in the wash if I never wear them?
God damn it, for occasions like this, duh!
I drive him to Union Square, to that hotel where Fatty Arbuckle did whatever he did, and when he gets out of the car, I am happy to see him get out of the car, the little dickhead. I go back to the office where Moody and Paul and Zev are working on Adam Rich's final interview, which we are purporting to have obtained exclusively. Question. Who do you admire most?
Adam Rich.
Spencer Tracy, James Cagney, Babe Ruth, especially the Babe. Here's this guy who everyone, players, women, alcohol, tried to keep down, but he just kept pointing to the fence. It's kind of what I try to live up to. Every morning I get up and I point to that fence.
So every morning you play baseball?
No.
Huh.
Well, that's a pretty good attitude to take. You seem to be very accepting of the peaks and valleys of the typical Hollywood career.
It's about having a vision.
It's been frustrating for me lately as an actor. The most important thing I've learned is that the past can be a block to the future.
Surely opportunities exist.
Yes, but I'm not going to throw emphasis on my past to make a buck.
We have only a week left to finish the issue, not to mention the Chronicle work, a whole campaign for the paper's columnists due the next day. Herb's blurbs. Read Herb Kane. John Carroll. Let's go caroling.
As usual, we make it look easy. I drive back to the hotel so I can get Toph, then bring Toph home, then go back to Union Square, to Sari's hotel. I slow down in front of the Fatty Arbuckle Hotel, hoping to catch Toph on the steps, waiting for me outside. He's not there. I drive around the block, and when I come down Polk again and pause in front of the hotel, he's again not there, and there's a motherfucking cable car behind me, full of idiot people hanging off. Whee! So I drive around again, and when I come to Union Square, tourist clusterfuck, Fuck it, I'll just park underground, and so I do, and then run to the hotel, into the lobby, in my shorts. I'm already almost late for Sari. She will be waiting. She has to fly out tonight. She had a convention today and is flying out tonight. But by the time I get Toph and drop him off, she'll be gone. Fuck. There are some kids walking out with their parents, but he is nowhere. He is not in the lobby, as other kids awaiting their parents are, and he is not on the steps, as a normal child might be, and not in the doorway, and not by the elevators or front desk. When I ask, a willowy girl in his class says that no, she hasn't seen him for a while, but that some kids are still upstairs. Maybe he's up. I ride the chrome and mirrored elevator up, assaulted by the garish red carpeting, then the view. It's an outdoor elevator. View of the whole city. How nice. And upstairs, the room is all glass. There are balloons, sadly, resting on the floor. A DJ packing up his equipment. Two kids are left, dressed up, one in suspenders. Toph is not among them. I ride the elevator down with one of them, ask him, but he doesn't know where Toph is. Out the front door, the steps, into Union Square, another ridiculous cable car, tourists everywhere. No Toph. Sari will be gone. My one chance with the sexologist, squandered by this inconsiderate little... I go to a phone and see if he's called. He has not called. Back to the hotel, scan the lobby, back up the elevator. Look at the view, so nice. Inspect the party room again, which is almost empty now. Only a few parents, who look at me quizzically while I look at them desperately, but cannot talk to them because I am not them and do not know what to say. If I explain, it will only confirm their low expectations of me, strengthen their fear and pity for little Toph. I ride down again, and in the mirrored elevator, I look like a madman, and maybe he's dead. He was taken, of course he was taken, like Polly Klass was taken, and is right now being molested and dismembered. Or first driven to another state. Not possible. Of course possible. It's probable. All probable. Sari will not wait. Oh, to be able to just fucking once do something. Be able to do something simple and normal, like shacking with the author of sex manuals. Just that one little thing. Goddamn, can I just have this one thing? Oh, wait. That's it. He's gotten a ride from a friend. Yes, a ride. The little dickweed without telling me he got a ride from someone else. If I find him at home... No, he's still here. I'm sure of it. I look in the hotel's phone room, the restaurant, the bar. Why the bar? Why the bar, dumbass? Think. Then up the elevator again. Oh, what a nice view. And such a leisurely pace, this elevator. Then off and in the party room. No one left. Then down, then outside. Then into the park across the street. Then around the block. And he's definitely gone now. He's as good as dead. Been taken. Of course, the same age as Polly Klass, right? Oh, God, I will become Mark Klass. I'll initiate legislation, Toph's Law, I'll start a foundation. Then back into the lobby where he is standing by the door, his shirt untucked, his hair matted, looking outside through the hotel's thick gold glass doors on his tiptoes. I grab him and say nothing until we get to the car, and inside the car, with the windows rolled up, after he gives me his excuse involving his thinking that I would be picking him up at the other door, a door other than the door at which I dropped him off, after I patiently listen, interesting, without swearing, trying not to yell. I do not want to do these things. These things are not what we're about. No yelling, no swearing, that's verboten. No anger, no outbursts, no threats of doing this or that, hitting him here or there. Instead, I calmly, slowly, softly, as if reading Chaucer to senior citizens, avail him of my way of seeing things. God damn it, Toph, that makes no goddamn sense. The other door? Why the other door? Are you kidding me? God damn it, god damn it, god damn it. Damn it! This shit cannot happen. Sorry, pal. This cannot happen. I mean, please, Toph, please. This kind of thing is just ridiculous. Raising voice to his and my surprise. Fucking ridiculous! I mean, this shit just cannot happen. There is no room for this kind of shit. Pounding steering wheel. God damn it! God damn it! God damn it! I cannot be driving endlessly around the city looking for you, wondering when I'll have to call the police, wondering what dumpster they'll find you in, molested and torn apart and... God damn it! Jesus fucking Christ, Toph! I had just about written you off. I went through that hotel 10 fucking times. I was picturing you in a million pieces. That Polly Klass killer guy giving me the finger at the trial. Everything. Fuck this, man. There simply is... Pounding steering wheel. No margin for error here, my man. There is no margin for error. Pounding steering wheel with each syllable. No margin for error. Listen.
You know this. We know this. We've always known this, that the only way we can do this is with a certain amount of efficiency. We have to be thinking. We have to be on our toes. We have to be on the same page. Have to be anticipating, thinking. We have to have presence of mind. Things are pulled taut, Tove. Pulled taut. There's no give. No give. Everything is too tight, brother. Everything is just right there, like that. Clenching fists. See that? Tight. Taut.
Jerking fists apart, miming the testing of a knot in a short piece of rope.
Everything is pulled taut.
You just passed our street. I drop him off at Beth's, watch him step into her red foyer, wave to Beth as she waves to me, watch the door close, see them start up the stairs, knowing he'll tell her everything. I cannot worry now, not when there is Sari. I do not know what exactly Sari wants. Maybe she's getting revenge. This could be her getting back at me for having fun with her book, making me come up to the hotel room, which will be empty. Or when I walk in, someone will douse me with something. Whipped cream, tar. This whole thing is a big setup. It's a trap. I would deserve it, certainly. I deserve anything. Everything. No attack would surprise me. But it's worth the risk to be with a sexologist. She will know everything. Full of tricks, tips, explosive things. Will pull things out of me that I didn't know were there. I call from the lobby. I was about to leave. I have to catch a plane in 2 hours. I'm here. I'll come down. I am waiting to see the sexologist. Sari. Sexologist. Sari. Sexologist. But how bad is this? Friend in a coma, Tove at Beth's, maybe crying, shaken up at least. It's the first time I really exploded. Did I explode? I exploded. I sounded like them. And I'm waiting for this woman who I've known all of 3 hours. The elevator splits, and she is there, with the suitcase, striding toward me, and, when close, smelling so good. We decide to skip dinner, to go straight to my house. We'll have an hour before her flight leaves. We get in my car, and there is rain, and the tenderloin is gauzy and bright. And on the way home, all the green lights are timed, and then we are alone in my room. I am with the sexologist. All is lush. We are progressing, still clothed, but progressing. On a bed with the sexologist, on a bed with the sexologist, on a bed with the sexologist. What does that mean, to be here with the sexologist? There's nothing better, yes? This is it, right? I'm not married, and I will die soon. 3 years, maybe 5. And Shalini would be wanting us all to be enjoying ourselves, even with, especially with a sexologist in from New York. A one-in-a-million chance here, I know, Shal knows. And thus, I'll be adding joy to the world, not depriving. Deprivation does no one any good. I will be adding something to the world, this experience to the world, and more so, Sari and I will be further weaving ourselves into its fabric by doing things. Anything, anything at all. One is weaving oneself into the fabric. It is okay for me to have sex with a sexologist while Shalini is in a coma. How could we say no? Our being together means that something is happening, and the happening of things equals a moral good, which equals an irreducible good, which equals existing, equals defiance, equals pulling, equals pushing, equals proof, equals faith, equals connection, plus hand-holding, equals affirmation, equals swimming to the rock and back, plus holding breath underwater all the way from one side to the other, equals the fighting of fights, tiny fights, big fights, any fights, equals the proving of points all the time, equals denial of the tide, equals flouting of decay, equals force minus restraint minus moderation minus nail-biting minus no-saying, plus wall-punching, plus volume turning upping, plus quick lane changing, plus car passing, plus light making, plus yelling, plus demanding, insisting, staying, getting, equals defiance, equals handprints, footprints, proof, equals tree shaking, fence cutting, plus taking, plus grabbing, plus stealing, plus running, equals engorging, equals no regretting, equals insomnia, equals blood, equals soaking in blood. And what Shalini needs is the connection, the pumping of blood, the use of the lattice. She needs her friends not only there by her side, but she needs us being as close as possible. Not only to her, but to each other, creating friction, noise, and if possible, she needs us having sex with each other and projecting that energy to her, the bursting and love. It all connects, ha ha! Shalini would want us having sex. And then, with Sari, just mild groping at this point with our eyes closed, then the thumping of empty shoes on the wooden floor, the thinking of all the things you'd think about with your eyes closed while feeling and positioning and rubbing, like, for example, space travel. Walking on Mars in a 2001, a Space Odyssey-style spacesuit, everything dusty, red. Then images from a lavishly illustrated book owned throughout adolescence, positing what space travel might look like 3,000 years hence. The moon-sized spacecrafts, the towers miles high on planets heretofore uncharted. Then Shalini's eyes, closed and purple. Then your lack of a condom, And then you're giving AIDS to Sari, and you're having to tell Sari a year hence when you are diagnosed and having to wait. No, you'll do it through the mail, being unable to face her. You'll have moved to Greenland or Franz Josef Land by then, or else you will still be here, and we'll tell her in person, and we'll ask her to marry you, and together you will fight through AIDS because... No, she won't want anything to do with you, asshole. The door to the building opens and closes. Then the door to the apartment opens and closes. Then the door to the bedroom opens. Toph. Oop, he says. I walk out. It's the first time he's caught me. Not that we were all that engagé, but still. He's looking in his closet, just standing, looking. What are you doing here? I ask. What do you mean? You're supposed to be at Beth's. She didn't have any food. She sent me home. Listen, head back there and eat. Tell her she has to. Tell her to order something. I'll come get you in an hour. He leaves. I return to Sari. She's standing to go. Then to the airport. Silence. Idle talk. Outside the car, we hug. She passes through the airport's glass, and I watch, blinking stupidly. It's unclear what we've done, whether something happened, whether we broke through, whether proof was provided. Accompanying Adam Rich's final interview is a full-page photo of Adam, mid-laugh. The caption reads, "Didn't fear the Reaper." The spread is great. It looks perfect. Everything down to the last detail. Photos of him growing up, the one with Brooke Shields towering above him, even a bizarre shot of him at age 9 or so with Moody's new girlfriend, Michelle. She and Adam went to the same school for the arts. It's all pitch perfect, everything dead on, believable. This will be big, we think. This will be big, we say. Yes, this will be big, we say. Things finally seem aligned for us, with our rental situation seemingly stable, advertising somewhat better, the staff at a maximum with 6 or 10 or 20 interns, and now our new East Coast helper person, a 22-year-old actress waitress named Skye Bassett, whom Lance has somehow roped into running around New York for us, doing meetings, planning an upcoming party, running errands. An actress? We say. Yeah, did you see Dangerous Minds? She was one of the kids in the class. It was a big role. She's on the box and everything. So, what does she want with us? It is a standard response. We are suspicious of anyone who offers to help us, worried about anyone who actually does. Those, like Zev, who move across the country to do so, for free, well... I rent the movie soon after, and sure enough, amid the black and Latino kids, at risk you see, there is a pretty white girl with dirty blonde hair. She is tough and wears too much makeup. She has speaking lines and everything, and now she's running around New York for us! She waitresses 30 hours a week at the Fashion Cafe, acts or auditions 20 hours more, squeezes our garbage in somewhere between. When she phones, she is manic and funny with a husky voice. She is one of us, and with her, and with this Adam Rich thing, it really seems like we might be turning a corner here. Maybe we should really make some kind of push, actually put together a kind of business plan and get a bunch of millions of dollars and finally dominate and have bridges and grade schools named after us, arrange for the trip in the space shuttle, and maybe Shalini will get the money too. Maybe she'll get back in there and do her thing because Shalini has been in the coma for about 2 weeks when Marnie and I go one day, a bright weekday at about noon, and are led inside where Shalini is there with her eyes open. Jesus fucking Christ. We freeze. We had not been told that her eyes were open. We want to run and tell her family. Her eyes are open, but not open in a vacant sort of way, but open. Absolutely. She's looking at us. I move a little to the side to see if her eyes will follow me, and they do, slowly. Slowly, but she must be... Hey, Sal, Marnie says. Awake. We wash our hands and come over to one side of her bed. Maybe we forget to wash our hands. And lean over in the usual way, holding her arm all the while. Her eyes are following us. At least one eye is following us. The other eye is not moving, but she's really watching us with those huge eyes, or eye, looking completely amazed by our presence. The stunned, mute look of a newborn. God, her eyes are huge. The whites of her eyes so gigantic, bigger than before, it really seems. Maybe twice as big as before. The world is in bloom. She is back. We have not lost her. She's obviously back and hearing us, and we'll talk soon, and then maybe in a few days be up and about and then back to work, chatting, creating, assembling, and finally resuming the back rubs. One of her friends comes in. We give him an urgent sort of look, casual but urgent, not to alarm anyone, but Jesus Christ!
We tell her to wiggle her toes, and she waves her foot back and forth. It's spectacular. It's Jesus and Lazarus and Christmas. Afterward, though, in the waiting room, we are told by one of the doctors that even with her eyes open and her seeming to be cognizant, she is still, technically, comatose. That it is not unusual for someone still comatose to open one's eyes to respond to basic commands. We can't for the life of us figure out what that means. To us, it's obvious that she is awake, is back, and that it might have been us, Marnie and I, that made it happen. We leave, dizzy, catapulting. The cars in the parking lot shimmer. The sky is full of doves and big dancing puppies all singing early Beach Boys songs. I put my arm around Marnie as we walk to the car, and by the time we get to the car, I have a fantastic idea. My idea is this. Marnie and I should have sex in the car. My head is on some new planet, a just-found planet that's full of flora and fauna and winged deer and snakes that harmonize, and I am so giddy that when we get in the car, I just sit there and grin at Marnie. We both are alive and have known each other for all these years and have made it this long, so long. We are so old and tired and have not been killed and have not fallen from a bridge or balcony or rickety deck. I'm really thinking that the very best way to commemorate all this is for Marnie and I to be naked with each other and sweating at her apartment, mine, in the car. It doesn't matter. The beach, the park. I need to take my clothes off. I can't drive. We sit in the car in the hospital parking lot. I can't do anything else. I can't go back to work. Sex is the right thing. She was staring at us, I say, thinking of sex. It's incredible, Marnie says, not thinking of sex. She looked amazing, exactly like her. I mean, her eyes were following us, I say, thinking of Shalini's eyes, then of sex, and about whose apartment, mine or Marnie's, is closer. Yeah, it was definitely her, so alert, Marnie says. I pause and look at Marnie and hope that my thoughts, those relating to sex, seep into her brain and are already there. She looks ahead through the windshield, hoping that at any moment I will start the car. When she turns back to me, I am still looking at her, with the grin. I don't know how to broach the topic. Now a shy grin. Maybe a shy grin will work. I know this sounds really strange, I blurt, but I'm really horny right now. There is a short pause as she diagnoses the depth of my confusion. That I am not kidding. I am thrown because for a minute there I thought she might be on my planet, which also has water slides, but as it turns out, she is not, after all, on my planet. I think we should get back to the office, she says. She is right. She is good. She never gets upset when I do this. It was a dumb idea, a revolting idea. All wrong. Bad. I ask her for a hug. She complies. While hugging, I get another very, very good idea. That Marnie and I should have sex. I drag the hug out for a minute across the bucket seats, thinking again that maybe she's warming to the idea, that maybe she'll change her mind and we'll complete this circle. She pulls away, pats me on the shoulder with three mini-pats, like those used to pet reptiles. Okay. I turn the car on and back up and drive out of the parking lot, and we head back to the office, the city looming up ahead, all jagged and white, all the buildings standing there, smiling, chuckling, a bunch of huge, happy people. They understand. Adam Rich insists on being picked up at the airport. I have paid for him to fly up so he can come to a party for the release of the issue and do a few radio interviews. I had gently suggested that the shuttles to and from SFO were just great and cheap, too. I take them all the time, but there had been a long pause, and he had then, as he had before, let me know that I was not dealing with just some high school friend coming into town. I was dealing with a major Hollywood presence, someone whose stamp had long ago been put on that zip code, a made man. He was Adam Rich. No airport shuttles for Adam Rich. No half-assed motel rooms for Adam Rich. Get serious. Perchance, was Adam starting to believe the auteur bit? The genius working on squatter project deal? I pick him up in my Civic. I am late. I am running through the carpeted hallways. I run up the escalator to the gate, then down to the baggage claim. I will have to page Adam Rich. He will not like this. Is that you? I turn around. Adam, you're late. And there he is, Adam Rich. I guess I knew he was kind of short. I knew this. I will not act surprised. He is impeccably tanned, buff almost, with gelled hair, a goatee. He is wearing precisely the outfit he wore in the photo shoot. Tank top, surfer shorts, sunglasses. He looks pretty great. We walk to the car. When we hit San Francisco, the first thing he wants is a cigar. He must have some good cigars. He has been enjoying cigars, he insists, long before their enjoyment became so faddish, and wants me to stop at a place he knows of on Market Street so he can pick up some of this brand and that, the kind you can't just get at 7-Eleven. I've made a reservation at a hotel near Van Ness. I've never seen the hotel before, had found it in the phone book. You'll like it, I say. It's close to stuff. It's not close to anything. But it was cheaper than any other place I called, and their ad was clear and had by far the nicest illustration. We pull into the parking lot. It's a sort of Red Roof Inn just off busy Van Ness, close to a car dealership about 3 blocks from the Tenderloin. There is no air conditioning, no pool. He is not happy. He is exasperated. He wants to be near the water, as he clearly indicated when we spoke on the phone. We drive to the wharf. Once there, I stop at a payphone and look through the yellow pages. He is waiting in the car, sunglasses on. 10 minutes later, I have a place, a Best Western, with AC, a pool, 5 blocks from the Sea Lions. I drop him off and pay for the room. Over the next 2 days, I will do anything he wants, for we feel we owe him, because the issue, the cover of which reads, "Fare thee well, gentle friend, Adam Rich, 1968-1996, his last days, the final interview, the legacy he leaves." Has hit. And hit big, relatively speaking, of course. When the issue was making its way to newsstands, we sent out, from our Brother 600 fax machine, a press release to exactly one media outlet, the National Enquirer, fully intending to lie to them about the article's veracity. In the interest of diverting questions from us, thus keeping the hoax alive for as long as possible, we planned to pin the story and its fact-gathering on its elusive British author, Christopher Pelham Fence. All inquiries would be directed to him, though, oddly enough, he would be unavailable for a week, as he was on assignment in, we think, Romania? 8 minutes later, there was a breathless call from a producer from Hard Copy. We had not faxed Hard Copy. "Why haven't we heard about this?" he wanted to know. "Man, that's a good question," we said. "Have you talked to any other TV outlets?" "No, you're the first." "Good, good. Can you get us his family, friends?"
Sure, yes. Maybe yes."
The logistics were getting complicated too fast. Who will play his mom, his dad, the neighborhood grocer?
"Well, first," we said, "we'll have to track down, you know, Mr. Pelham Fence. He's got all the details."
We were caught unprepared. We assumed that they would take our word for it. Well, if an obscure, error-filled magazine in San Francisco says so, then it must be true. We didn't think the makers of Hard Copy were sticklers for things like facts. A few minutes later, the producer called again. "The LAPD has no record of the murder."
"Oh."
"Well, not that they would have to, but they wanted to believe it as much as we wanted them to."
"Well," we say.
20 minutes later, he called again. "There's no record of it anywhere in Southern California. Is that where it happened?"
"Well, yeah, we think."
"Do you have any more information? What day was it again?"
Flipping wildly through the magazine for the article, "if I remember correctly, it was, you know, you really should talk to Mr. Pelham Fence. Of course, he's in Bucharest at the moment, and it's, what, 3 a.m. over there by now?" And
we hung up and strategized. We tried to get Paul or Zev to be Pelham Fence. They both refused. "No way. I can't do a British accent." The producer called again.
"No one's heard anything about this. We called his manager, and he says it's news to him."
Within an hour of the fax, the jig was up.
"Listen, guys, what's going on here?"
the producer wanted to know.
We told him. "A hoax. Funny."
He was unamused. He was angry. He hung up. It was over. Or not. Not for Adam, for the machinery had been set in motion, and it would be a few weeks before it would slow. An AP reporter, apparently slow in the uptake, tracked down Eight Is Enough dad, Dick Van Patten, in rural Missouri, wanting a comment on the untimely death of his TV son. He was beside himself. He reportedly sobbed. It was all over the internet. People debated it in chat rooms. Most of those who knew it was fake were furious. Most people weren't sure. Adam's friends and ex-girlfriend spent days in shock, believing he was gone. One girlfriend, assuming he was dead, called his home number just to hear his voice on the answering machine one last time. Adam picked up. She swooned. He called us in a panic.
Listen, you guys, this is way out of control. My relatives are fucking freaking out.
We sent out another press release, this one explaining our big ha-ha, asserting that its phoniness should have been obvious to all, knowing that it was not, that the humor was self-evident. But of course, the notice is complete with a short note from Adam telling everyone at our urging to lighten the fuck up. But then came the backlash. They tore Adam to pieces. There was a piece in The Inquirer, segments on American Journal, E, mentions in dozens of AP papers, a spread in the New York Post. Most of the stories, given an excuse and a motive, dredged up his past, a semi-sordid melange of drug abuse and petty larceny, with very unflattering results. And almost to the last, they accused him of using this stunt, this fake death, this egregious manipulation of public sentiment, as a cheap way of getting his name in the papers. The next morning, I pick him up at the Best Western for the first of two radio interviews.
"So what are you working on these days?" asks Peter Finch, the compassionate disc jockey at KFOG.
"Well, I'm putting together a period piece, a costume drama."
"Great. Wow, and you'll be
producing and directing."
Adam is amazing. I expected disaster, expected that callers would tear into him, that the DJs would make fun, but everything stays above board, and Adam is composed, assured, well-spoken, still a performer, still in control.
Afterward, he comes back to the office, signs copies of the issue, his signature confident, full of strong lines, grand loops, one of which, a short while later, Zev and I bring to Shalini. She has been moved to a new hospital down the street from Toph and me, in a bright room with a view of Knob Hill. She is cognizant, has had 10 or 12 or 30 operations on her head so far, will have 150,000 more. We entertain her and her mom, reading her letters aloud and filling her in on office goings-on. Her short-term memory is shot, so she doesn't really remember Zev too well, and has to be reminded of many of the people we're talking about.
"Oh, you know who's in town?" we say.
"You'll love this."
"Who?"
"Adam Rich."
"Oh, my God! Why?"
"Well, we did this issue. We did this story where we pretended that he was dead, and I'm thinking this is a great story, but in the middle of the story, I glance at her mom, and her mom is not liking the story. The story is perhaps not appropriate. Of course it's not appropriate. Her mom, so small, has been by Shalini's side for months, through countless edge-of-oblivion situations, the all-nights wondering and listening to breaths, everything I know, and still I come in and say these things. I'm an idiot. I looked to Zev for help, but he hasn't seen the look from Shal's mom. I change the subject. We stay for a while. They've moved most of the stuff from the old room to this one. The pictures of her family, friends, the big black-and-white ones of her, stuffed animals, flowers, her portable CD player, books. I didn't plan to look for it, but then it occurs to me, and I can't help but look around. It is no longer wedged between her arm and torso. It is not on the side table or on the windowsill. I casually step around the room, eyes scanning, thinking that maybe it's here, but in a place of honor. It could be in a glass case somewhere. But there is no glass case. The bear is gone. I don't know what it means that the bear is gone. The bear's eyes were my mother's eyes, and I put the bear on Chow's bed so that she would be healed, and now the bear is gone, and everything is still uncertain. The only sure thing is that I can't be trusted with anything. The party for Adam is awkward. We have spread magazines all over the club, and all the attendees are walking around with them, leafing through, Adam's face staring out, glassy-eyed, already a phantom. And so when I walk around with Adam, introducing him to people, everyone is confused. They look from their magazines to Adam and back. They do not know what to make of him. He is both a 70s icon, a fragment of their childhoods, and a purportedly dead person. Both facts preclude him from walking among them, trying to get a few of the more diminutive women at the party to come back to the Best Western to swim in the pool.
"I think Adam Rich just hit on me," one friend says. "Is that really him?" they ask. "What's he doing here?"
Even when he gets up on the small stage to speak, people still do not understand.
"But it says right here in this satirical magazine that he's dead. How could..."
Those who catch on are still unimpressed. The fact that he is at this party thrown by an obscure magazine at a mediocre club means that he, by being here, by association, is himself unimpressive. To have him walking around in this small nightclub, all crushed velvet and rounded bars, would mean that he would be desperate enough to fly up from L.A. to work this crowd to slum in San Francisco, reminding everyone of what he once was, what he might be again. It was freakish. Or sad. Could he really be doing all this for attention? Could he really be milking his own past to solicit sympathy from a too long indifferent public? No, no, he is not calculating enough, cynical enough. It would take some kind of monster, malformed and needy. Really, what sort of person would do that kind of thing?